Again, in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 9. Now, three times this passage refers to Pharaoh sending. We might think that in these chapters of Exodus it's only Yahweh who sends. He sends the plagues, of course. And certainly our passage this morning does feature the verb used in that way, used of God sending plagues. But as I say, it also includes three occurrences of this verb where Pharaoh, not Yahweh, is the sender. And our study of this passage then is going to revolve around those three occurrences. We're going to consider Pharaoh's sendings. And first of all then, ascending for confirmation. That's the first one. Ascending for confirmation. So we saw last week that striking feature of plague number four, the flies, the way in which God put a division, that's how it's phrased in chapter 8, verse 23, put a division between the Israelites and the Egyptians. That is, the flies terrorized the latter, but didn't remotely bother the former. Now, we're not told what Pharaoh made of that particular detail when Moses announced it to him in advance, that there would be this division between the Israelites and the Egyptians, one people left alone, the other people targeted. We're not told what Pharaoh made of that. Perhaps he was incredulous. Perhaps he thought even Yahweh, who Pharaoh now knew could do some pretty amazing things, even Yahweh couldn't control the precise movements of swarms of flies. Perhaps he thought that. And perhaps, moreover, the plague of flies came and went with him, unable to verify whether that part of Moses' announcement had come true. While the plague itself was in full swing, conditions weren't exactly conducive to dispatching a royal fly inspector to the land of Goshen to see what was going on there. I've had the experience of being mobbed by swarms of midges in Scotland, and it's unbearable, as some of you will know. They're in your ears, they're in your nose, in your mouth, your eyes, your hair. You start flapping wildly, you start hitting yourself madly, you go into a kind of survival mode where all that matters is escaping the midges. If you're putting up a tent, when they descend, then you'll leave guy ropes untied and part of the ground sheet unpegged just to get inside the tent and zip the entrance up. If you're eating a picnic when they descend, you'll leave the sandwiches for the seagulls to eat. Just all that matters is getting back into the car and escaping the midges. And I'm saying if the swarms of flies were anything like that, then Pharaoh's inspectors wouldn't even have made it down the front steps of the palace, let alone to the Hebrew quarter there in Goshen to check whether the plague was affecting the Hebrews or not. And then, of course, once the plague was over and travel was possible again, it was too late. There was no point in then doing a fly check in Israelite territory because the flies had now disappeared from all parts of the land anyway. And so, as I say, Pharaoh may have had his doubts about the Israelites being exempt from the fly plague, but he wasn't really in a position to investigate. Now, however, in the first part of chapter 9, it's plague number 5. And this time, too, Moses' announcement signals a distinction between Israelites and Egyptians. But this time, that distinction is verifiable, because this time the plague consists in livestock dying by some disease or other. Now, there's nothing in that to stop Pharaoh's investigators making the trip to Goshen. This time they can travel there, and they can walk round, and they can visit farmer's field after farmer's field, counting the dead animals, observing the carcasses of sheep and cows sprawled all over the place. And so in verse 7, Pharaoh sends. He sends his officials with their clipboards and their forms to fill in. He sends for confirmation that this stuff about division, a division between Israelites and Egyptians, it was all claptrap. Confirmation that Israel's livestock has met the same fate as Egypt's livestock. And thus sent, then, the officials go. And they arrive in Goshen. And they visit farmer's field after farmer's field. But there's no counting of dead animals. There's no observing the carcasses littering the countryside. All they see in Goshen is healthy specimens. Flocks and herds untouched by the plague. Behold, verse 7, not one of the livestock of Israel was dead. Pharaoh doesn't get this confirmation that he was looking for. Whether or not he sent for similar confirmation after plague 6 and 7, we don't know. But we do know that those plagues followed exactly the same pattern. The boils in plague number 6 came upon all the Egyptians, verse 11, i.e. not upon the Israelites. And the hail in plague number 7 spared only the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were, verse 26. And we need to appreciate then what all this would have meant. We live in a country where, at a time of national crisis, the government can order everyone to stop doing their jobs and can then, for months on end, pay everyone's wages for them. That's what we've seen over this past year. And yes, we know that has consequences for the economy, but it can be done. Countries couldn't do that kind of thing in the ancient world, not even the strong ones like Egypt. They didn't have resources to absorb crises. They relied on there being animals to farm and on there being crops to harvest. And these three plagues here in chapter 9, therefore, all of them affecting livestock, one of them affecting crops as well, they would have brought the land of Egypt to its knees. They would have had a devastating impact there. And the Israelites' exemption from these plagues then, the Israelites' ability to carry on as normal while Egyptian livestock died and Egyptian crops were ruined, it would have meant a dramatic reversal of fortunes. A reversal of fortunes in which the free, noble citizens of Egypt wilted while their slave people, the Israelite scum, the Hebrew vermin that they kept in a ghetto in Goshen, they prospered. I mean, recall the situation back in chapter 5, verse 12. So the people were scattered throughout, that's the people of Israel, were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. Do you remember I said what a poor substitute stubble was for straw? And how hard it was to get out of the ground. What a pathetic sight the Israelites must have been, crawling on their hands and knees through dry, stubbly fields, which offered to them so little. How the Egyptians passing by those fields must have laughed and shouted their abuse and perhaps aimed a few kicks at the defenseless Hebrew groundhuggers. Who would have thought then that in a few months' time it would be the Egyptians crawling through the fields, desperately looking for any stalks that might have survived the terrible hailstorm, while the Israelites experienced no such problems? What a reversal. What a reversal. And God, of course, had brought about this reversal. You know, I think we get a little glimpse of God's heart in one detail that we can easily overlook in plague number 6. Verse 8 says, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take handfuls of soot from the kiln and let Moses throw them in the air in the sight of Pharaoh. It shall become fine dust, etc. What was the significance of kilns in Egypt? And why did Moses and Aaron have such ready access to one here? When you read kiln here, don't think delightful pottery projects. Think bricks. Bricks. Kilns were used to make bricks. And Moses and Aaron had ready access to a kiln then because the Israelites were constantly making bricks. And I'm sure it's no coincidence that in this plague here, we have it originating in this very precise way, as if God is saying, I see my poor people laboring at those wretched kilns 24/7, burning their hands on the red hot metal, getting cancer from all the soot penetrating their lungs. Well, here's a bit of vengeance. The soot from one of those kilns is going to cause boils to break out on the Egyptians. I know there are different motives in God's heart as he sends out these plagues on Egypt, but I'm saying the appearance of this kiln here indicates, I think, that one of those motives is his distress at the way in which his people are being treated by their oppressors. And that distress remains a reality in God's heart whenever his people are downtrodden. And boy, many of his people are downtrodden in our world today. In Egypt, ironically enough, Coptic Christians routinely overlooked when applying for jobs because they're not Muslims. In Pakistan, Christians treated very much as second-class citizens whose wages often simply don't get paid. In India, flooding occurs and the government's aid program disadvantages Christians. It's much harder for them to access the food packages than for others. And so we could go on. And I'm saying then God sees these situations. He takes note of the kilns, or whatever may be the equivalent symbols of his people's oppression. And one day, it's going to be reversed. One day, his people will no longer be confined to the margins of this world, scavenging for whatever crumbs their powerful oppressors leave them. One day, they'll be heirs of this world. That's what Jesus says. The meek, that's my disciples, will inherit the earth. The small-scale reversal of fortunes that we see here in Exodus 9 will explode onto a whole new level then when Jesus returns. And God will say to those Christians from Egypt, from Pakistan, from India, it's all yours now. My world is all yours. Your oppressors have gone. They won't bother you anymore. Their situation is now very different to what it was. This world is yours now. And they will never come back and trouble you again. And even for us Christians in the UK who don't really know what it is to be downtrodden, isn't there some comfort there? You think of the leader of the opposition party in our parliamentary system, and he visits a church in order to commend it and congratulate it for the relief that it's bringing to needy members of its community. And then he finds out subsequently that that church believes that marriage is the lifelong union between one man and one woman. And how apologetic he is for having ever visited that church. And those Christians in that congregation are made to feel like such disreputable, unwanted lowlife, covered in shame as one of the country's leading politicians publicly dissociates himself from them and is so sorry that he ever compromised his dignity by paying them a visit in the first place. I'm saying one day that situation will be reversed and God will parade on the last day the members of that church before men and angels. These folk, he will say, they were faithful to me. They were faithful to my word in 21st century Britain, where my word was hated and maligned. How proud I am of them. And as they are honored, the elite, the politicians and the media people who so despise those Christians and their bigotry, they will then be covered with shame. There's a great reversal coming, of which the one that we see in our passage is merely the faintest anticipation. And so that's the first sending, ascending for confirmation. But then notice with me secondly, ascending for animals. Ascending for animals. So the hail plague has lots of interesting features, doesn't it? It feels a bit different, even just the amount of material that we have devoted to it. You get this phenomenon sometimes in the Old Testament when you have a long sequence of items, numbers 7 and 10 in the sequence are particularly big. You get it especially in genealogies. The double climax is what scholars call it. There's a climax at number 7, and then there's another climax at number 10. And I think that we may well have that with the plagues. The hail, number 7, and the death of the firstborn, of course, number 10, they both feel particularly big. And one of the things that makes the hail plague different, that makes it stand out, is the fact that God builds into it a protection scheme. He says to Pharaoh in verse 19, "Now therefore, send, get your livestock and all that you have in the field into safe shelter, for every man and beast that is in the field and is not brought home will die when the hail falls on them." So that's the sending for animals that I'm talking about. Pharaoh, and by implication all the other Egyptians following their king's lead, is to send for his animals in order to protect them from the impending hail. It's a remarkable feature of this plague. And at one level, it may be God having a bit more fun with the Egyptians. We saw him last week, didn't we, having some fun with the magicians, putting them in a situation of having to attempt tricks with these frustratingly uncooperative little gnats. Now, one of the features of the plague so far has been the invasion of the Egyptians' houses by different creatures. Frogs invaded their houses, we're told, and flies invaded their houses. Well, now, in verse 20, notice God takes this motif a step further, a rather big step further. Now, the Egyptians' houses aren't going to be merely invaded by frogs or flies. They're going to be invaded by cows and sheep and horses and donkeys and perhaps even camels. The mind boggles somewhat here. And I think we can detect at least a faint smile on Yahweh's face, the more so because in this case it's the Egyptians themselves inviting and driving these huge animals into their kitchens and their living rooms and their bedrooms. So at one level it's that. But at another level, it's God's mercy. It's God's mercy, giving the Egyptians here an opportunity to limit the damage done by this terrible plague. In this connection, verses 15 and 16 are very important. And at first sight, notice, verses 15 and 16 don't seem to make much sense. So this is God speaking through Moses. He says, "By now," verse 15, "I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But for this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power." So God is saying there that, you know, here we are, plague number 7. I could have just wiped you out with one plague, but I haven't done that. Instead, I've kept you. And I've done that in order to show you my power. And you think, well, that doesn't make sense, does it? Surely it would have really demonstrated God's power if he just wiped Pharaoh and all the Egyptians out in one single blow. That would have demonstrated God's power like nothing else, surely. But you see, in verse 16, God doesn't simply mean, "I have raised you up to show you the extent of my power." He means rather to show you the character of my power. To show you the character of my power. To show you, Pharaoh, that my power isn't the kind that goes around unleashing judgment at every opportunity, enacting punishment right, left and centre as brutally and devastatingly as it possibly can. My power is different. It's a power that holds back. It's a power that knows restraint. It's a power that's reluctant to cut off even wicked Pharaoh and the Egyptians from the earth. It's a power that's reluctant to allow all the Egyptians' animals to be struck down by hail. Or indeed all the crops, we discover that, don't we, in verse 31 and 32, all the crops to be wiped out. They're spared too, some of them, just like the livestock are. That's what God is saying in verse 16. He's saying, I've raised you up, Pharaoh, not to simply demonstrate how great my power is in its quantity. In that case, I would have just wiped you out in a single stroke. But I've raised you up to show that my power is different. My power is unique. There's restraint and mercy built into my power. And the fact then that seven plagues in, or six plagues in by now, you're still standing, is such a manifestation of that. There's a hymn, isn't there, that we sing sometimes, I think it's 847 in Christian hymns, O Jesus, full of truth and grace. And there's a line in one of the verses there, it's a Charles Wesley hymn, a line in one of the verses that speaks of your gracious power. Your gracious power. And that's, I think, what God is getting at here at verse 16. I've raised you up, Pharaoh, to show not simply my almighty power, but my gracious power. But we might object, hang on a minute, that's a bit pointless, Lord. It's a bit pointless to display your gracious power to Pharaoh. It's lost on that buffoon. It's throwing pearls before swine. Doesn't make any impression on him. Doesn't do him any good. What's the point in showing Pharaoh your gracious power? Show other people your gracious power who might appreciate it, Lord, not Pharaoh. But think of this. Think of a television interview. And you know how it is in a TV interview. There's an interviewer and an interviewee. And most of the time then the camera is just focused on the interviewee. That's all you can see perhaps, just that person. But sometimes perhaps the person is in mid-flow and the camera angle just changed slightly and you can see the interviewer and she doesn't seem to be paying the blind bit of notice. She's kind of looking at her notes, looking to see what the next question is that she's going to ask. And do you think, well, it seems a bit rude. Why doesn't the interviewee just kind of march off? Disgusted and offended at being shown such disrespect. Well, of course, the reason is that both of them understand the dynamics here. They both understand that the interviewee is not really talking to the interviewer. It looks like that. But the real audience is beyond the interviewer. The real audience is those watching at home on their TV screens. Now look again at verse 16 here. For this purpose I have raised you up to show you my power, Pharaoh, my gracious power, so that my name may be proclaimed by you. No. So that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. In other words, the real audience isn't Pharaoh. He's like the interviewer in my illustration. The real audience here for this display of God's gracious power is people from all the earth who will be impressed by this display of God's gracious power. The word proclaim there is the word that's used often in the Psalms, especially for worship. It's that kind of proclamation that's in view, proclaiming God's beauties and God's excellence in a doxological sense. There are those who will see the display to Pharaoh, and though it's lost on Pharaoh, they will be impressed, and they will proclaim God's beauty. Who are these people? Well, in the near future, there's not many obvious candidates. There are some. We think perhaps especially of Rahab. Remember how at the beginning of the book of Joshua, we encounter her, and she's a pagan, she's a Canaanite, she's a prostitute, and yet she has heard there in Jericho of the mighty deeds of Yahweh, and she's been attracted to this God like none she's ever heard of before, who has such gracious power, and she wants to join with the people who worship this God. So there are ones and twos, but there aren't many. Who then are these people in view in verse 16? Well, it's us. It's us. It's people from all over the world who now, in these days, love to turn in their Bibles to the book of Exodus and watch God mixing these judgments on Egypt with such surprising mercy. And who then put down our Bibles. And who then say, oh God, we adore your beautifully gracious power. That's why we're looking at this passage this morning. That's why in 2021 we're doing a sermon series in the book of Exodus, not because we're fascinated by ancient history, but because we're fascinated by God. And God reveals himself in the pages of Exodus, and particularly in this portion of Exodus, he reveals himself as a God of such extraordinarily gracious power. And we recognize that gracious power, don't we? As we encounter it in Exodus 9. We recognize it because we've experienced it firsthand ourselves in our own lives. This resonates with us. It strikes a chord with us. We ourselves have been the beneficiaries of this gracious power. We spent years of our lives rebelling against the God who made us. We deserve an unleashing of God's power to destroy us in hell. And he did unleash his power on us, but not to destroy us in hell, rather to rescue us from our condition, changing our hearts into believing ones, and thus uniting us to Christ, and in him transforming both our guilty status and our addiction to sin. Such gracious power. That's why we love Exodus 9. Not just because it's a gripping narrative and we learnt it years ago in Sunday school. We learn it because it resonates at the deepest level. We see here the God of our salvation. The gracious power that's writ so large over our status as Christians this morning. Writ in smaller but real letters over the plague drama there in the land of Egypt. And so this display of power, completely lost on its original audience, Pharaoh and the Egyptians, it causes us, as its secondary audience, to proclaim in worship God's great name. So we've seen two sendings, ascending for confirmation, ascending for animals. Thirdly and finally, ascending for relief. Ascending for relief. So this plague of hail is very severe. That's made emphatic, isn't it, in the account, the way in which it's the worst disaster that the Egyptian nation has ever faced in its history. The way in which there's even this mysterious fire involved in the hailstorm. Is it lightning? Is it something more abnormal? It's not entirely clear, but it's a very, very severe plague. And so in verse 27 then, Pharaoh sends. He sends for Moses and Aaron, but of course he's sending for Moses and Aaron not to sit around and have a cup of coffee, but in order to secure relief from this plague. And strikingly then in verse 27, he uses the S word, he uses sin language. Now we know, don't we, having read the passage, we know not to take that too seriously, to take it with a pinch of salt, because of course, just a few verses later, he changes his mind and he initially promises that he's going to let the Israelites go now, and then the plague stops and he changes his mind, which shows, doesn't it, that there was no real repentance going on in verse 27. He wasn't really mourning his sin. But actually, even without going any further than verse 27, I think it's evident even within the verse itself that Pharaoh here is not on a biblical wavelength when he talks about sin. He's not talking about sin in the way that you and I would, in the way that the Bible does. Because notice how he says there, this time I have sinned. This time I have sinned. And you think, well, hang on a minute, Pharaoh. What about the previous occasions when you were commanded to let the people go? Before there any plagues had even occurred yet. And you said no. And then after each plague, you've sometimes said yes momentarily, but then you've said no again. But what about those occasions, Pharaoh? Why are you saying, this time I have sinned? As if you haven't sinned prior to this. Well, Pharaoh, you see, has a distorted perspective. I think there's one little hint of that even in the artistry of the narrative itself. Just in verse 33, we read Moses went out of the city. Interesting, by the way, isn't it, that Moses is able to go out of the city in the middle of the hailstorm in order to pray to Yahweh. So that Yahweh's protection isn't even just geographically focused, but he can protect a single Hebrew walking out in the middle of the hailstorm. It's quite remarkable. But anyway, Moses goes out and stretches out his hands to Yahweh. And then we read, the thunder and the hail ceased, and the rain no longer poured upon the earth. And then we read, when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased. You notice that that's exactly the opposite way round from how it's just been put in verse 33. In verse 33, the order is thunder, hail, rain. Pharaoh sees that the rain, hail, and thunder has ceased. And I think that may just be a tiny, tiny little hint by the narrator as to what Pharaoh's fundamental problem is here. His perspective is completely distorted. He doesn't see reality as it is. And he doesn't see sin then as it is. He uses the language, but his definition of sin is distorted. It's skewed. It's twisted. So that when he says here, this time I have sinned, what he really means is, this time I have shot myself in the foot. This time my resistance to Yahweh's command has backfired on me rather disastrously, to the point that my whole nation has been plunged into ruin. And if this doesn't stop, it is going to unravel altogether. That's what he means. One of the commentators uses the word miscalculated. That's really what Pharaoh's saying. I've miscalculated. I've been a bit of a Wally here. On this occasion, I've stepped a bit too far in resisting Yahweh, and now I've landed in an awful lot of hot water. That's what he's saying. That's his definition of sin. It's sin because it's brought painful and adverse consequences, and he feels out of his depth now. That's what makes it sin this time. Previous occasions, he could cope with things. And so that wasn't sin. This time it's sin because it's backfired on him so badly. But of course, that's not the biblical definition of sin, is it? The biblical definition of sin is irrespective of whether it backfires on you or not. Irrespective of whether you land yourself in hot water. Irrespective of whether there are painful consequences. The biblical definition of sin is that you are resisting God and rebelling against God and not complying with God. And Pharaoh was doing that, as I say, from the very first moment that Moses and Aaron went to him. His sin doesn't start here because the plagues have been escalated now. His sin started back then when no plagues had even been sent yet. And this is important because you also could possibly have a faulty, skewed, distorted definition of sin. And it may be that you come here and you hear me and others talking about sin and what a problem sin is and how sin in your life needs to be dealt with, and you don't take that seriously. And you don't take it seriously because you say, well, my life's going perfectly well. And so there's no major problem that needs to be dealt with. No major sin problem in my life. Everything's going fine. It's going swimmingly. But that's irrelevant. Your sin is your rebellion against God. The fact you are not putting him at the very center of your life and living for his glory and living to bring him pleasure. That's the sin. And your life may be going swimmingly, but that sin is as real as if you, as it would be if your life was in pieces this morning. And so you do need to take this seriously. And you do need an answer to it. You need Jesus Christ. That's the only answer to sin. You need him. Doesn't matter how successful things are this morning for you. Doesn't matter how well you may be doing, professionally, educationally, financially, relationally, all kinds of spheres. You have this problem that is sin. And if it's left undealt with, you will go to hell. It's as simple as that. You need Jesus Christ. Cry out to him to deal with your sin and save you. And do that without delay. Amen.